Ethan Allen Institute presents Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre.
Our mission is to help people better understand the fundamentals of a free society: individual liberty, private property, and limited government.
Common Sense Radio, brought to you by the Ethan Allen Institute. I'm Bill Sayre. And one of our principal purposes is to apply the principles and ideals of a free society, many of which are embodied in the idea of free market economics, along with political freedom and civil freedom, to better understand public policy issues and to point us in the direction of some solutions. And from time to time over the years, the pricing of our pharmaceuticals has come into focus, and usually a fair amount of controversy. I can remember years ago when one of our senators, before he became a senator, would sponsor bus trips to Canada to buy the same pharmaceuticals we could get here in America, but for a much lower price. That's come up again in recent years, in recent months, and it's been mixed together with some of our policy about tariffs and other executive actions. We're going to learn a lot more about pharmaceutical pricing today, the factors that affect it, and the consequences of policy decisions that affect pricing. Some of the consequences are intended, some are unintended. And who better to help us do so than Jeremy Niall Hossian of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. We're going to discuss pharmaceuticals, pricing, and all the related issues that are so important to our well-being here in America. Jeremy, do we have you on the line?
Hi, yeah, I'm here.
I'm good, and it's mighty good to hear your voice. Well, suppose we get started by addressing one of the questions that will come up sooner or later in our discussion, and that is, what proportion of the new breakthrough drugs, many of them life-saving, roughly, because there's no exact calculation, what proportion are developed here in the United States as opposed to the rest of the world? It has started.
Yeah, I think a significant portion of the development of pharmaceuticals is done here in the United States. According to recent studies, it's been changing a little bit over the last few years, but right now it's around 50-60% of pharmaceutical development is done in the United States. Mm-hmm. But even that is a little bit of an understatement, because even if the United States isn't directly developing them, or I mean, this number is referring specifically to U.S. companies developing these drugs, but other companies and other countries also rely on the United States market to develop drugs, because, as a lot of people understand, our drug prices are, especially our brand name drug prices, the most recently developed, are the prices here in the United States are higher than most of the rest of the world, and those prices that we're paying are helping companies in other countries also develop their drugs. Mm-hmm. So when I say that 50-60% of drugs are developed in the United States, that's not counting the development that our market is driving in other countries as well.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose we're going to find that some of that has to do with pricing policy, but before we get there, tell us how long it generally takes to develop a new pharmaceutical and what the cost is on average.
It takes a long time and it's very costly. at the moment, the average developing drug takes between 10 and 15 years to go from the initial phase all the way to being sold on the market. And most of that is taken up by clinical trials, where the drug is tested in different stages to ensure that it is both effective and safe for use. And so there's like a little bit of a ladder there where there's one phase where the trial is very small, and then it gets bigger and bigger and encompasses more people. And then finally, after 10 to 15 years, the FDA approves it and it goes out for sale. And this entire process at the moment costs about $2.2 billion per drug. And that's been going up more and more. I think like 10 or 20 years ago, the statement was $1 billion per drug, and now we're above two.
Yes, I remember that. And part of the description, Jeremy, was it costs $1 billion to develop the first pill and 5 cents for every pill after. And that highlights part of the problem in evaluating pharmaceutical pricing. Give us your thoughts.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's an enormous fixed cost to develop the product itself, because you have to, like, there's chemistry involved. You have to test these different formulas, what the effects are going to be, how it's going to interact with different people in different circumstances, the effects both on the targeted ailments, but also any side effects that it's going to have. But then once you do all that testing, which costs almost $2 billion, the actual manufacture of the pill is very, very simple. Usually you just have a set of chemical reactions in a big vat and some very cheap constituent parts, and you can mass produce those molecules and the delivery mechanism for not much cost. It's kind of like, it's not dissimilar from like music, which might be a good example, where an artist spends a lot of time and effort coming up with good melodies and tunes. But then once they have that, I mean, you can CDs are cost like a penny. But even now with the internet, reproducing music or art is much less than a penny. But that doesn't tell you the cost it took to develop it in the first place.
So in the old days, we used to say $1 billion for the first pill, 5 cents for the second. We might say $2.2 billion for the first one today, and 11 cents for the second one, and everyone thereafter. And it's not very much. And this idea of such a drastic drop in the incremental cost of production helps us understand the complexity of this market, and also can help us perhaps defuse some of the acrimony over differential pricing. Our guest today is Jeremy Nyohozian, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong in that pronunciation, Jeremy. I'll probably just call you Jeremy today. But he's with the He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is a national free market institute, think tank, some people call them, just as ours is one for Vermont, Ethan Allen Institute. And he does research on the healthcare industry and markets and related issues. If you've got a question, and I'm sure many of you do, about how our pharmaceuticals are priced, you can give us a call at 244-1777. Well, Jeremy, let's talk about this contentiousness, and it does bother people, and it has on the surface of it at least a great unfairness associated with high prices for our pharmaceuticals here in America and much lower prices overseas. There's something called market segmentation or legalized price discrimination that might help explain that, but give us your thoughts.
Well, I think it's the pharmaceuticals are kind of a tricky business because they are providing a product and a service that most people really need and can really improve people's lives. So the value that people place on those drugs are very, very high. And the cost of developing them is very, very high. And on top of both of those things, the value to the healthcare system in another way is very high, because presumably what pharmaceuticals often do is they reduce the use of the healthcare system in other ways. So, if you take drugs that, you know, reduce your chance of a heart attack, for example, I mean, that reduces the costs of the healthcare system in general. So there's value to the system as well for these drugs. And so because the value is really high and the cost is really high, the price tends to move towards a level that compensates for those things. Mm-hmm. And then it creates this, like, shock reaction from everybody who wants it, because it's, like you were pointing out earlier, the actual cost of production once the drug is developed is very low. So then it gives this impression that the drug companies are taking advantage of the need, even though in a lot of cases they're compensating for their development costs and they're still producing benefits for the economy, even at those higher rates. And so other countries are more interventionalist than the United States, and they set up their healthcare system at a very top-down level. Like, for example, in the United Kingdom has the National Health Service, which is almost entirely government-run, and then other systems have different degrees of intervention, too, whereas the United States is a lower level of intervention, and particularly in the commercial market, where the United States hardly doesn't interfere nearly as much as they do in Medicare. Mm-hmm. But these other countries, they set up these bureaucracies, these administrations, where they try to take all the data they can. What's the effect of these drugs? What was the cost of the drugs? What's going to be the value to our government, which is paying for these health services? And they put all those numbers into a formula and then output this is the price we should pay. And there are downsides to that. And you see those downsides in other industries or sectors, like rent controls, or in the 70s when they had price controls on gasoline and oil. Mm-hmm. Where it creates shortages if you are selling products at a price lower than the market rate. And you see shortages in drugs in these other countries because of this reason. And so the drug companies are involved in this elaborate negotiation with all these other countries, trying to get the best price they can and help offset some of the costs of the development.
Let's build on that last point, as we do so well. Note that we may get another chance to see how price controls work if there are government-run grocery stores created in New York City. But I digress. Let's stay on that last point there. The drug companies then have a chance to fill a shortage that has occurred in another nation. Might be France or European, it might be even Canada, who knows, it could be any nation, including some nations in impoverished parts of the world where there is very little resource for families or for a society of any kind, and yet they have the same health challenges, perhaps different ones, I should say, but certainly as grave as the ones we face here. So they could use some help on their pharmaceutical costs from time to time. Their shortage is really more pronounced because there wouldn't be any of the drug at all. So if they could get some from an American company, even at perhaps especially at a low price, that's a great benefit to them. Low-income, poor people, throughout the world. But let's build on this point here about segmenting the market. When, if we take for a moment the premise that the American price is allowing the pharmaceutical companies to recover their cost of research and development. Some people will dispute that, but let's take that as a premise for now. Then, and the extra production of those pills or drugs is 11 cents a pill, then if they can get 12 cents, never mind 20 or 25 cents a pill from people in other parts of the world, then that's better for the pharmaceutical company and also better for the people who otherwise would not have those pharmaceuticals. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. And also, it's hard to expand that thinking, though, to the richer countries that could afford higher levels of drugs. Because if all countries paid just above the cost of production, mm-hmm. If they only paid 12 cents for the 11 cent drug, mm-hmm. as far as manufacturing, then the drug companies won't have the $2.2 billion to develop those drugs and get those drugs from idea to market.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the drug companies are trying to, you know, balance all of these different situations. And I think, you know, if other countries would pay closer to the value of the drugs, then we could actually have, maybe the prices in the United States would be lower, and maybe we'd have even more innovation in the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, that's quite a powerful idea, and I'm going to figure that's part of what the president has in mind when he's mixing together tariff policy and pharmaceutical pricing. Explain that for us.
I think one of Trump's goals is to try to get other countries to pay more for some of these drugs. And there's also a push from other think tanks to try to, you know, corral President Trump in that direction, to be more about getting the foreign countries to pay a little bit more, mm-hmm. than to try to control prices here. But in general, if the other countries did contribute more, I think that could produce two different possibilities, where the prices in the United States wouldn't need to be so high, or also there'd be more innovation around the world. And I think one thing I might not have mentioned yet, but that $2.23 billion for development, I think that's a United States number. And mm-hmm. Drug companies also have to go through processes in other countries to get their drugs on the market. So it's even more costly. The total cost of development is higher than even the $2.2 billion number.
Mm-hmm. And so, yes, if especially these centralized healthcare systems, usually a public, nationwide, national system of healthcare, including the purchase and resale of drugs, in a more wealthy country, if we could persuade them to pay a little more, certainly more than the 11 cents per pill, that would help reduce the cost here in America and spur more innovation. Is that a fair description of what you're suggesting that we consider?
Yeah, I think that's right. And as far as the tariffs, I also want to be clear that the tariffs won't directly promote this outcome. In fact, they'll probably be, if tariffs are just set on pharmaceuticals directly at higher rates, it'll probably be, counterproductive, mm-hmm. because the end result of that likely would be that the United States would be paying more for the drugs we're importing, so prices would go up, but also maybe we'd produce more in the United States. But just given the United States economy, it's hard to imagine how we could produce more without sacrificing some other production somewhere else. So maybe that comes from higher value drugs. Maybe that comes from other industries that we prefer at the moment. But I think the tariffs by themselves would probably be detrimental to both drug innovation and the cost of drugs. But as far as a negotiating tactic to try to get countries to contribute more themselves to drug development, I think that could possibly work.
Might
I also
help.
Want to point out that with price levels, mm-hmm. and inflation numbers, so far this year, drug prices are actually down by about 2% since President Trump went to the White House. And I don't think that's unrelated to the fact that drugs have been largely exempted from the tariffs that he has put on.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Well, yeah. Neither your organization nor ours is very keen on tariffs and think they do more harm than good, and this is one more example. Well, let's go back to this idea of an effect that price controls have on innovation here in America or wherever they're imposed. And that seems to have been the strategy, public policy of preference for the previous administration to control the price of new pharmaceuticals. And it's mixed in with this populist view about the low incremental cost of a pharmaceutical compared to the price that people pay. What will happen if we continue the policies of the previous administration and impose further and further controls on the price of pharmaceuticals? What will happen to innovation? Your thoughts.
Well, I think what will happen is what happens in any industry where prices are determined by some authority rather than the combination of preferences of consumers and suppliers. And that effect will be that there will be a mismatch in supply and demand, and people will want more drugs than they can get. And I think in the short term, that might cause shortages of particular drugs that are already available. And in the long term, that will cause a reduction in innovation and reduction of creation of new drugs in the future. So I think it's hard for me to ever think of an example where price controls are beneficial, even though they're very appealing. They're very simple, and they seem to solve a problem. Mm-hmm. But it misses the more complex things that are going on in an economy that no one can possibly understand or account for. And so then it creates problems down the line.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the short run, it might make the prices lower for some of the drugs that are commonly used and purchased. But if a new breakthrough drug is never created, never invented, some people will say, well, we don't miss what we never knew. And that happens in the case of a lot of new ideas and new procedures, new services and products. And one of the beauties of a free market society is that there is more entrepreneurial spirit, more innovation, more exercise of ingenuity. And we have some drugs today, you could list two or three, I suppose, that if there hadn't been the $2.2 billion worth of research and development, at least in constant dollars over time, we'd have never had those. And we might have people who are with us today who would have died. Say a word or two about that, Jeremy.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, even now there's development of new Alzheimer's treatments that will extend lives and reduce the really difficult effects on families of Alzheimer's. And I mean, if we don't continue to innovate, we'll just live with this disease as it is for forever, which is not something I think anyone really wants to do. And it's also, to your point, something that you don't, you can't see if the policies change, right? If the if we never develop these drugs, and we are just stuck in this situation forever, then no one really knows that it could have been developed and what life could have been with this innovation. But also those like Wegovy and those GLP drugs, I mean, they're reducing obesity, which has been a big problem in the United States for a long time, and it's becoming a bigger problem across the world and causes its own detrimental health effects. But I mean, there's innumerable examples of this.
Indeed, there are. Jeremy, we're going to take a short break for CBS News headlines and a couple messages. Then we'll be back with Jeremy and continue our discussion about pharmaceutical pricing, the factors that affect it, and how public policy can affect it too, sometimes in ways that are not so good. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
CBS News Brief. Secretary of State Rubio sets the stage for tomorrow's Trump-Putin summit in Alaska.
The president's spoken to him, I believe, four times by phone. I felt it was important to now speak to him in person and look him in the eye and figure out what was possible and what isn't.
Trump has warned of consequences if there's no end to the war in Ukraine. CBS New York meteorologist Craig Allen keeping tabs on Tropical Storm Aaron.
The track right now is from east to west and eventually will become more of a northwesterly track. So that would keep the core of the storm away from Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, Haiti.
And the same is likely for the East Coast. Taylor Swift used her boyfriend Travis Kelce's podcast to reveal more about her new album. It's due out in about 2 months.
Every single song is on this album for hundreds of reasons.
CBS News Brief. I'm Steve Kathan.
I've been in units in New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Massachusetts. Serving in Vermont has been the most enjoyable time I've had. I mean, the units up here have a lot more opportunity. I'm Lieutenant Mitch Cannon. I'm an infantry officer in the Vermont Army National Guard. If you're in Vermont, or even if you're not, if you're interested in joining the military and the Guard part-time, Vermont is the place to go, in my opinion.
Learn more at nationalguard.com/Vermont. Sponsored by the Vermont Army National Guard.
Hi, everyone. This is Dave Bingham from the Barry Elks Lodge, here to talk about our 9th annual golf outing to benefit the Silver Towers Camp on Friday, September 5th at the Country Club of Barry. Registration starts at 9:30, followed by a shotgun start at 11. The Silver Towers Camp is an overnight camp for people with disabilities owned and operated by the Vermont Elks. If you would like to participate, please reach out to me at 802-233-0049.
In his recent press conference, Governor Scott noted that we have a workforce crisis, a housing crisis, an education funding crisis, a property tax crisis. And, you know, I'll add to that a public safety crisis, a substance abuse crisis, and a general affordability crisis. Hi, I'm Rob Roper, your new Tuesday host for the Vermont Viewpoint, where we'll be exploring the root causes of these problems and some possible solutions. Tune in Tuesday mornings for the Vermont Viewpoint with Rob Roper.
This is my right, a right given by God to live a free life, to live in freedom. Talking about freedom, I'm talking about freedom. I will fight for the right to live in freedom.
Welcome back to Common Sense Radio, brought to you by the Ethan Allen Institute. I'm Bill Sayre, and today we're visiting with Jeremy Nyohosian of the Competitive Enterprise Institute about pharmaceutical pricing. It's been a controversial issue over the years, sometimes more so than others, but it's come back into focus these days as it's getting mixed in with tariff policy. But it allows us to think about the consequences of public policy intervention in this particular market, or any market, is an example of what would happen in any market. If the price is controlled, there's very likely going to be less innovation, less creation of life-saving drugs. Drugs that we might say, well, we never missed them, so it's not such a problem that they aren't invented. But just think of the people, as Jeremy was indicating, in your lives who are threatened by Alzheimer's or some other disease or illness that could be addressed, at least in part, by new pharmaceuticals. And that's why they're so expensive. Not the incremental cost on the last pill produced, but on that research and development cost, which averages $2.2 billion per drug. Well, we're going to learn more about that from Jeremy and other public policy ideas, some good, some not so good, in a moment. But first, I want to thank David Zuckerman for a great set of interviews, as always, on Vermont Viewpoint before our show. I particularly enjoyed his discussion with those who are concerned about whether our republic can withstand a period of time in which the leadership in Washington is a little different than what they would prefer. That may be a discussion that has points of view different than we might have, but it is certainly a discussion that we support and believe should occur as we aim to try to understand views that are different than our own. What is it that's important? What are the arguments, constitutional or otherwise? I believe it was David who noted that you tend to rely more on the Constitution when the party in power is of the opposite view than your own. And that's a truism, I think, that if you look back through history is largely valid. After our show, I hope you'll join me in listening to Lee Cattell bring us some midday news. Lee's been working yeoman duty these days. I've noticed that Bob Welch taking a little time off, but he starts at 5 or 6 in the morning and keeps going to about the same time in the evening. What a trooper Lee Cattell is. But he'll be bringing us all the latest and most important news, sports, weather, business and finance news during the noon hour. That's important for us to know as we do our best to understand the events and circumstances that affect our lives, our families, and our community. WDEV has been providing that news, but also a range, a variety of public affairs shows since 1931, almost 100 years. And it is this variety precisely that helps connect us to one another, because we get to hear views usually described and explained by someone from our community, with calls to the shows where people can agree or disagree, but in a civil manner. And that's how we learn, by making comparisons. With Jeremy today, we're talking about the free market approach to these issues, in particular pharmaceutical pricing. But there are other approaches, and many people in Vermont agree with those. They usually involve a bigger role for government in our lives. And to me, we should each and every one of us ask questions, think about the answers, and then make up our own mind. That's the way a free society should work. It's the only way it can work if we're to sustain our noble experiment in self-government known as the United States of America. Well, let's get ready to go back to Jeremy. And as we do so, I invite you to be with us tomorrow when we'll have Whitney Hull of UVM Research Extension Service. And we're going to be talking about those robotic milkers that we discuss from time to time and what the consequences of those are for our farmers and the ability of our farms to remain competitive when labor supplies are so short and there are related issues of contention about migration. They have a place in the market, and we'll learn about that tomorrow from Whitney. Well, Jeremy, let's go back to you. And I think it'd be good to weave in a few other strands of thought when it comes to pharmaceutical pricing. One that we hear sometimes is that, well, okay, maybe it does cost $2.2 billion, but a lot of that research in a new drug is done at the National Institute of Health, which is paid for by the taxpayers. I don't know if that's counted in the $2.2 billion or not. I don't know if there's a distinction between basic research and specialized. Help us understand.
So yeah, in general, the $2.2 billion does not include the money from NIH. NIH, they spend about $45 billion a year on biomedical research, but most of that research is at a very basic level. It's fundamental, like how medicines work or what are some mechanisms of diseases, and it's research, it's academic research. And I think this might help indirectly pharma companies do their own research and figure out maybe what they should look for, what they should target, what they should develop, how they might approach problems. But when the drug companies take it upon themselves to actually target a disease and come up with a new medicine, the $2.2 or $2.3 billion, that clock starts fresh. Mm-hmm. And so they start developing it on their own. They have their own team of researchers, their own chemists and, just general scientists that are looking into some of these drugs and how they might work and what they should focus on and how they should work on it and how they should develop it. And then, obviously, I think the big chunk of that $2 billion number is really those clinical trials. Mm-hmm. And those aren't funded by NIH. NIH is more funding the basic research that is three or four steps below that.
And that's as it is in other products and markets. I'm thinking now of when we didn't have such tight labor markets, you might get the state or federal government funding basic training, but specialized training would be the responsibility of the company that hired them. And it makes sense. Basic research could be used by any company, any enterprise that wanted to make use of it, but the specialized pharmaceuticals that address a particular disease or illness, that would be the responsibility of the individual company. Another issue closely related to all of us who believe in free markets and free society is the idea of a property right as you make a discovery or an invention. And in fact, I believe we were one of the first nations in the world to build that into our Constitution, the patent rights in the Constitution. And surely this is a factor, and we hear about it whenever there's a discussion of generic drugs, they have, in effect, the producer, the inventor, the company, has, in effect, a monopoly on selling that particular drug for a certain number of years, and then it's open to anybody who wants to copy it and more widely distribute it. This affects pricing, too. Start us out, Jeremy, by reminding us what the rules are for a company that wants to create a new pharmaceutical.
Right. So once they get to the, drug companies can apply from the patent office for a patent, mm-hmm. which gives them the sole ability to sell that drug for, I think it's 7 years. And so then the drug companies basically have a monopoly on whatever they develop. And then other companies can develop their own treatments for similar diseases, but they can't use the same chemical or molecule to treat it for 7 years. And then as that timeline gets close to the end, there's actually a pretty good process for transitioning from the patent-based monopoly over a molecule to generic competition. And like for the there's an amount of time where one generic manufacturer can produce that molecule and sell it by themselves, so they get a little bit of an exclusivity deal too. I mean, it's not 7 years, it's like maybe 6 months, and then the market opens to all generic manufacturers, so it kind of helps ease the system from a sole monopoly into a very competitive system. And even after the drugs move into the generic phase, the brand name, the original developer, often still sells their drug under the brand name and competes with the generic. So there's even it shows that there is a value, just like in other industries, to being the originator and to having a brand name associated with the drug you're selling. But the generic system works really, really well in the United States. As much as we talk about how much higher drug prices are in the United States, our generic drugs are actually cheaper here in the U.S. than in other countries. And generic drugs make up about 90% of the volume of drugs in the United States. So when people are listening to these issues, you just have to always kind of be mindful of what numbers people are throwing around. And even though brand name drugs represent a higher proportion of the cost of drugs because the brand name drugs are higher priced, the generic drugs are actually substantially higher volume of U.S. pharmaceutical sales.
Mm-hmm. That is fascinating, Jeremy, and I didn't know that, and I'll bet many of our listeners did not either. So 90% of the volume that I'm figuring by that, you're saying 90% of the actual number of pills produced. But what about the percentage of the value? Naturally, the name brands will be more expensive. Would generics
I think it might be the reverse. I think it might 90% of the value price-based is brand name drugs in the United States.
Okay, 90% is of the value is name brand. Okay.
Right. I probably shouldn't have used value and volume.
That's okay. Sometimes my hearing isn't so good. At least it shows I was paying attention, Jeremy, because it got my attention. So 90% of the value is name brand, okay. And the 10% that are generic, though, because we still got a point to make, you are saying is less expensive than generics in other parts of the world. I did not know that.
Yeah, that's right. The generic prices are lower in the United States than in a lot of developed countries. And part of the reason why is because of the imports. I mean, the United States does import a lot of generic drugs from other countries. And generally, the imports help lower prices of products. I mean, for a number of reasons. One, you get to shop around. So it makes the competition kind of global. You also get to take advantage of other countries where labor costs are lower. And you get to offload some of your lower value manufacturing and lets you concentrate on higher value manufacturing. And I think that rule is pretty broadly applicable in a lot of industries. I mean, the United States might import a lot of goods, but in general, we import lower value goods, and it helps us produce higher value goods that we use and sell to other countries.
And it also shows that if people do want to save money and they do have confidence in the generic formulation, they can save a lot of money, and so can their insurance company. We've got a call, Jeremy, from Northfield. Lee Cattell tells me, yeoman worker there in the studio all day long. Northfield, Jim in Northfield, what say you?
Good morning. Can you hear me?
We can. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Two quick questions. One is, I do not believe in price control. The other issue that relates to that is the mandating of the government, especially during the COVID crisis, mandating people through businesses, you know, to take the mRNA gene therapy. Two is, can the guest speaker speak at all to the kickbacks that the NIH scientists receive? Fauci received, as well as other scientists, received kickbacks from pharmaceuticals. I look forward to your answer. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jim, for calling. And we might not use the word kickback. It might be some kind of a license arrangement or a shared benefit. Arguments, good arguments, Jim, on both sides. Let's hear what Jeremy has to say.
I guess the direct payments to Fauci isn't something I'm too familiar with, and I'd say, at least from an economic point of view, it doesn't seem very beneficial. It doesn't help the market, I don't think, operate more efficiently. But I think from a good government view, it just seems very problematic and something that would need to be avoided. I mean, yeah, having regulators being taking money, whether in different ways from those they regulate, is always something that needs to be carefully monitored.
Be skeptical. And as I think about it, I agree, and I think the first step, Jeremy, would be to making public all such payments, and I'm going to figure that would correct a lot of the issue by itself. But give us your thoughts also on that mandates through business of particular vaccines, and I don't know much about that mRNA except that it's very controversial. Tell us more about it.
Oh, yeah, I think mandates, I mean, at DEI and just philosophically, the idea that the government is mandating anything with regulations, whether it has to do with health or economics, I mean, these are things we oppose. I think we would oppose those kinds of mandates. But we prefer to focus on providing information, giving people choices, allowing them to make the choices, and setting up a system so that the choices can be made as effectively as possible with low prices and products that meet the preferences and the needs of consumers.
Mm-hmm. Let's pick up a couple of sub-issues in the pharmaceutical pricing discussions. One, is this right to try legislation that had been proposed for years and years and finally got passed, I think, at the end of the previous Trump administration? Could be wrong about that. But tell us what that legislation does and why it's beneficial to people.
Yeah, so the right to try was a law passed in 2019, I think, that allowed people who were in a life-threatening situation to use drugs that have not been approved yet by the FDA. And I think a lot of people think, well, what's really the downside here? It's the people taking the risk. I mean, there's not really much risk that they're taking because their risks are already high. Mm-hmm. And so the upside risk seems to be really outweigh the downside risks. And so the right to try legislation was an attempt to, like, smooth the way for that to happen more. It turns out that this hasn't been used very much because there's also a separate policy at the FDA, which is called the it expanded access, the expanded access program at the FDA, and it allows a similar availability of some of these drugs, and maybe because of familiarity by the physicians, because it's been in a possible option for a longer time, that the physicians have so far preferred to use the expanded access program than to try the right to try. But I think this is an idea that is pretty popular, I think, to allow people who can really benefit from some of these innovative and top of the line drugs to accelerate the process a little bit and try them out, which might help them when there's not much downside.
That's right. Another issue that's come up in the last two or three years or something called pharmacy benefit managers, and there's been some mergers of drug stores and insurance companies, and sometimes insurance companies and hospitals. Give us your thoughts on that whole trend.
Yeah, PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers, have become a bigger target over the last 10 years or so. And I mean, my honest opinion is I think it's a product of them being a middleman and them trying to drive down prices, and they don't really have direct customers. Their customers are generally insurance companies, which also often are their owners. But I think because of this kind of obscurity and opacity, they're starting to get a lot of they're in the line of fire pretty often. I mean, I would just say that it's kind of a vertical integration question where the insurance companies, they're paying for a lot of these treatments anyway, and so that means they pay hospitals, but they also have to pay for the drugs, and so then they use these PBMs to try to negotiate a lot of the complex parts of the pharmaceutical industry, because you've got the pharmacists themselves, you've got the doctors involved, you've got the manufacturers of the drugs, the wholesalers, and then you have, like we were talking about before, generic competition. So sometimes, like, one of the big things that these PBMs do is they figure out, they try to find the highest value option for some of these generic drugs or brand name drugs. Well, maybe not so much brand name drugs, but when generics are competing with the brand names and generics are competing with each other, one of the jobs of the PBM is to figure out, okay, so how am I going to get the lowest price? And similar to that, they're developing networks of pharmacists to try to find pharmacists who can offer services at lower cost than other pharmacists. So a lot of their job is to figure out this network to increase value. And I pointed this out before, but drug prices have gone down this year. And in fact, they've gone up more slowly than general prices over the past 10 years. And I think part of that is because of PBMs and pushing insurance companies and consumers to use more generic drugs.
Mm-hmm. And I expect part of that same downward pressure on inflation of pharmaceutical prices would be the big retailers like Amazon and Costco and Walmart in this business too. Is that a factor?
I think so. They're all kind of driving prices down. And sometimes I call PBMs like the Costco of drugs, because in reality, they're performing some of the same functions. Like, what Costco does is it's trying to find wholesalers and manufacturers and products at low price and pushing those prices down, developing these networks, and then selling them to a consumer through a subscription. And PBMs do some very similar things, but just very focused on drugs.
Well, Jeremy, we want to thank you for joining us today and giving us the benefit of your perspective, your insight, research, and expertise. We've learned a lot about pharmaceutical pricing today from you, and we appreciate it. There's a lot more to learn, so we'll I hope visit with you again in the future. We also want to thank all of you for being part of our listening community today, thinking about these questions. They're big ones, and they affect us every day. And we hope that each and every one of us is patient and kind and yet grateful to live in a free society where we can enjoy the blessings of liberty. Upcoming Lake Cattell and the Midday News. Keep listening, keep learning, but most of all, keep the faith.
WDEV FM Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, FM 98.3 in Montpelier.